Okay, so the four stages of enlightenment. It's a good thing to talk about the four stages of enlightenment because after this talk you know what you're in for. Sometimes we do these things not knowing what's going to happen. And after it happens you might not be, you will be very happy. Enlightenment is a very happy experience. So this is actually talking about what enlightenment is, but also exactly how it happens with the four stages of enlightenment. And it puts the whole practice of meditation in perspective. It shows you why you're doing this practice and why you're meditating for happiness, for peace, for letting go, for stillness, why jhanas are important, and actually how it all fits in, what actually happens, and why it happens, and the meaning behind what is happening. There's the four stages of enlightenment. And sometimes people, especially Buddhists, lay Buddhists in the world, they talk about enlighten this and enlighten that, so it's good to know what you're talking about. And the four stages of enlightenment, the first one is the stream winner, the second one is the once returner, the fourth is the third is the non-returner, and the fourth is the completely enlightened arahant. The four stages of enlightenment, the stream winner, once returner, non-returner, and fully enlightened arahant. Now the reason the first one is called a stream winner, it's like the word sotapanna. I mean, it's actually entered the stream, reached the stream, attained this current. It's like getting into a riptide, which you cannot swim against. It means that it goes all the way to enlightenment, and no matter what you do, you can't get out of it anymore. In other words, they call it the destiny is fixed. You're bound for enlightenment. There's nothing you can do about it anymore. There's no choice in the matter. No will. See, what happens here is actually starting to find out how this whole process to enlightenment actually happens. And you realize it's nothing to do with you anymore. It's like a snowball effect. You've already gone over that hill, and it's all downhill from there on in, and you can't stop it. It's a process. It's called the stream winner. And the major thing about the first stage of enlightenment, about being a stream winner, is being able to actually to see sort of non-self, exactly what's in this being you call you, and what's in other people. And it's important to be able to focus in on that and find out exactly who one is, what one is. And that's actually the whole, one of the whole purposes of the beginning stages of our path in meditation. However, there's many ways which people, you know, try and find out who they are. And many of those ways lead to dead ends. If it's just a way of thinking and inquiry, it doesn't get far enough. Simply because you just have not got enough data to really actually see the full picture. When you're only seeing half of the picture, you cannot really understand what's really going on. So, it's why we practice our meditation to get into jhanas, actually to see non-self. And the point of the matter is that there's always, if we're not a stream winner or above yet, there's always something which we take to be me, which we take to be myself. And once it's a me, and once it's a self, there is something always belonging to a self, something which is mine. There we get our ownership, and from ownership we get attachment. And craving is just trying to protect our attachments or to try and get more attachments. Really, craving is just what the sense of self does. That's its function. And I think you've heard me say it before, I certainly say this often in our monastery in Serpentine, that the only way you can really overcome that attachment and that craving, the only way, is actually to cut off the sense of self. In the same way, according to this simile, and this is a simile which I thought I'd invented until, I think when I was doing my long retreat, I had a copy of the new translation of the Sanghita Nikaya. And you can imagine what happens when you think you've made up this simile and you find actually the Buddha made it up, no, hundreds of years before you. I'm not quite sure if I remember that from a past life or what, but it certainly sent shivers up my spine when I saw that this was actually a Buddha's simile. And it was a saying that if you got a hand, you'd always do picking up. Because that's what a hand does. You know, you try with your hands for the rest of this retreat not picking up anything. You just can't do it. Because that's the function of a hand, to pick things up, to grasp and hold on to things. The only way you can stop grasping, the only way you can stop picking things up, is actually to cut off your hand. to throw it away, do away with it, so it's no hand anymore. When it's no hand, then you can't pick up anything. Logical, isn't it? That's what the Buddha said. So the only way you can stop grasping and craving is to cut off the sense of self, the sense of me and mine and I. And so that actually becomes the job of the first stage of enlightenment, to cut off the sense of self. And when you actually try and investigate the sense of self, you know, to find out anatta, it's an extremely difficult thing to do. And the reason is because you've got so much vested interest in maintaining the illusion. And that's why the path of trying to investigate anatta becomes one which is fraught with fear. And I don't want to do this. And I can't really see this. You all know, like psychological denial, you never see what you don't want to see. It's the same with the sense of self. You just don't want to see you're not here. And the very idea that, you know, that you aren't the person in control of yourself, but the will is just conditioned, again, is scary. It's even more scary that the one behind all of this, listening to this, hearing this, seeing this, feeling this, is not you. Again, it's very scary. Now, the problem with non-self is that sometimes that you take it too far. By taking it too far, you think there's actually nothing in here. Absolutely nothing. Absolute emptiness. It's all illusion. And this is actually where sort of I take issue, because you can't say it's all illusion. I prefer the word delusion. There is something there. There is this hearing, there is this seeing, there is this knowing, and you can't deny that. But what we mean by delusion, the difference between illusion and delusion, illusion is just a phantasm. It's nothing really there, it's absolutely empty, it's nothing. But with a delusion there is something there, but you're giving it a meaning it doesn't deserve. You're misinterpreting it. You're giving it extra qualities which aren't inherent in it. You're adding to the reality. That's what I call like delusion. And the reality is there's something there, there's the sensory experience, there's the knowing, there's the seeing, there's the feeling. But it's what we add to it is the problem. We add to that the idea of self, of an I, of a me. Will is. You can actually experience will happening. That is the reality. The delusion is to add the I in front of that will, that I will. Doing is. The delusion is for I do. Seeing is. The delusion is putting the I before that. I see. The I here. That is the delusion. We're adding something which doesn't really belong. However, it's very difficult to see that. Because there is something here and you want to know what is that. What is it that I am deluded to think is me, which I add something to? And what actually that is what we call this beautiful process. The process of rise and fall, cause and effect. What the Buddha called dependent origination. Because if you really want to understand about the first stage of enlightenment, you have to be able to understand about the truth of anatta, and also how that's connected inextricably with the Buddha's explanation of dependent origination. Because what dependent origination is meant to do, as I wrote in a recent article, which was published somewhere, the purpose of that dependent origination is actually to show actually what this is, this process, and how this process leads from one life to another. Without a soul, without a person, without a being that is reborn. Just a process continuing on. Past death into a new birth. Past that death into another birth. Taking with it karma, which is again cause and effect. Taking with it suffering and happiness, all cause and effects. And this is actually dependent origination. That's its purpose. When you actually see that this which you take to be a self, a me and mine, is just a process, well defined by dependent origination, just a sensory process. For those of you who actually know something about dependent origination, you can actually start to see its middle terms, so like from consciousness, sort of conditions, name and form, basically the objects of consciousness, and the name and form conditions, the six sense bases, conditions, contact, that's returning back the senses on, contact conditions, Vedana, feeling. You can actually see just this is just the process of sensory activity and just how it all sort of works together. Once it's consciousness, it's always conscious of something. And that whole process of sensory activity was described by the Buddha in those terms. But he also described where that comes from, why is there sensory activity, and where it goes to. And you can see that if there is delusion, avijja, not seeing clearly, and if there's also craving as well, then that leads to the whole process going on and on and on. Like, was it blinded by delusion, fettered by craving? This lovely word called by the Buddha, fettered by craving. Craving doesn't free you, but it ties you down, imprisons you. Desires are your prison. That's why there is never any freedom of desires. Because there's never any freedom in prison. There's only freedom from desires when the desires end. When you are untied to craving. And then when fettered by craving, blinded by delusion, this whole process goes on and on and on and on. You can actually see just how life goes on through that craving, through desire, through the wanting, through the reaching out for the next thing, the next pleasure, the next place, the next time, the next meal. You can see just how craving reaches out to create the future, to create rebirth, to create the next experience. And this is actually what keeps this process going. The reason why people do not even want to even consider ending this process is because they think that they're right in the middle of it. And ending the process means ending them. And nobody in their right mind, if they think that they exist, would want to end themselves. Yeah, end suffering. Yeah, end disappointment. But please don't end me. And this is a problem with human beings. They can't really understand enlightenment unless they understand that they are not there in the first place. So when enlightenment happens, as things are fading away, ceasing, everything ending, people get scared because they think that means they are ending. And even the Buddha said that in the suttas. He said sometimes when he teaches the Dhamma of non-self, he said sometimes people get terrified. Hey, does that mean that I'm going to get extinguished? That I'm going to get ceased, annihilated, exterminated? And the Buddha said, no, look, the people aren't understanding. You weren't there in the first place. So there's nothing to be getting annihilated. How can you annihilate something which was never there? All you're really ending is delusion. Now, those are very interesting and fascinating ideas. And people can look at those, they can study them, they can write about them, they can argue about them, but they can't understand them. And you see, so often that even monks, lay people, they all start thinking about what enlightenment is. Now, is there anything remaining once a person is enlightened? Is there like just a mind which is always going to be there, but sort of not conscious of anything, a non-manifest conscious, whatever that means. They have all these wonderful words, it is but it not is. And they have all of these statements. Like, you know, he who knows doesn't say, he who says doesn't know. It's all just trying to squirm out of actually giving a proper answer. And the proper answer, you know, you'll actually see. It's, I mentioned that with Kisa Gotami's enlightenment the other day. Because when a flame goes out. And this is a Buddha simile to Vajragota, one of the wanderers. When he described him, Vajragota was a great philosopher. He was a wanderer, but he obviously had a very, very sharp mind. Because the Buddha gave him some really, really deep similes. And one of them was about the flame going out. He said, and a flame is supported by the three things. Cause and effect again. By the heat, by the oil in the wick. The oil in the wax. The wax in the candle is supported by heat, by the wax, and also by the wick. Those three things. If the wick is used up, the flame goes out. If the wax is used up, the flame goes out. If the heat is blown away, the flame goes out. So what actually is a flame, the Buddha was saying? It's just the effect of those three causes. And so when one of those three causes stops, the effect stops. And you ask, where does the flame go? This is the Buddha said, to Vajragota. Does the flame go to the north, to the east, to the south, to the west? You can't say a flame goes anywhere. He said it does not apply. It's a silly question. Flames don't go anywhere. They were there, and now they're no longer there. That's it. And that was a simile for enlightenment. Now, of course, that is, should be, completely incomprehensible. You may have some understanding of it, but not really. Because the only way you can have understanding of that is actually to see just that which you take to be yourself is just causes and no effects. That which we call will, the doer. It's just like the flame. It's caused by many, many things. In Buddhism, we call it like the sankhara. It's the doer. That's the main part of the doer. Buddha said Chaitanya is the main one of the sankharas. And this is actually caused by avijja, avijjapachya sankhara, by delusion. That's why you will, out of stupidity. Why do you always, will to do things? Sometimes, people will to go and find their lovely partner in life and get married, and that's really stupid. People, will to get rich. But how many people actually ask me after the Thai New Year Day when I was speaking holy water, can you give us a lottery number, please? There's a 12 million draw on this evening. It's actually stupid if they wanted to be rich. Having all that burden to carry around with you. People want to be reborn again. That's absolute stupidity. So many of the things which we want, why do we want those things? When you look at it, it's absolute stupidity. How we to put your craving or desire or wanting or will. And actually, when you actually see it clearly, isn't it better to let go and not want anything, to be content? Isn't that what you're learning in this meditation retreat? The contentment gives you far more happiness than wanting. It's wanting, willing, craving promises happiness. It promises you the whole world. Just imagine it, want it, work for it, and then you can be rich. I think I saw an ad in the newspaper the other day. Make $1 million without getting out of bed. I don't know what scam it was. There's all these scams in the newspapers about how you can make lots and lots of money without even getting out of bed, just getting a mobile phone. I don't know what else you're supposed to be doing. And why do people actually want to do this? They're actually crazy. The people buy into this pyramid selling schemes, as good as knows what else, trying to become rich. Absolute stupidity. But here we realize that contentment is the greatest happiness. Contentment is the greatest wealth, said the Buddha. And actually you're practicing that here. Whenever you desire to get into deep meditation, you find you never can. As soon as you say, I'm going to be content, it doesn't matter what I'm doing, this is good enough. I'm content. Then deep meditation happens. It becomes blissful, becomes full of happiness. You find actually all this idea of willing and craving business, it is the biggest scam in the world. Someone should actually tell the government and have these people investigated, whoever started this craving scam. It's deceit. It's, fraud. The Buddha actually called the monks the fraud squad. Actually to uncover craving and stop this whole business. But you have to see that. And when actually you start doing this meditation, you stop willing and you find that leads to happiness. First of all, it shows you that how delusion creates will. And how through wisdom, will stops. And you stop will. You stop craving. You stop doing. In this meditation, you're practicing letting go, which is the opposite of willing. It's the stopping of the doer. Letting go. Allowing things to be. Being content. Being at peace. Being still. And in that not doing, in that letting go, that's where you see just the fallacy, the fraud of the doer. Not only do you see it as evil, but also you see it as just an empty fraud. Nothing there. You see where it comes from. And when you stop the cause of delusion, then doing stops. When doing stops, you realize that can't be me, that can't be yourself, it's just cause. And you experience it stopping. You find that you are not the one who does. There is no thing, person, or rather, no person or being which does. In the same way, there's no doer inside of you. There can't be any doer anywhere in this universe. Not only do you see the non-self, you also see the non-God. Go together. So if you want to know the answer, is there a God or not a God? Instead of thinking and theorizing about it, this is actually what you see. Actually what happens. These are all conditioned phenomena, rolling on. But no being, no ultimate person being in there. And then you go deeper actually to see what I mentioned the other night is the last refuge of the sense of self. The two citadels, the doer is the one, and the other citadel, the heart of it all, is the knower. Actually, there's a movie out now, isn't there, called The Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers. I remember reading that book years ago. You know, one of the towers is, who's that wizard who owns the second tower? Who's seen that movie? What's the name of that wizard? Saruman. Yes, right. So he's the doer. And that tower has to be overcome first of all. And who's the other guy, the really bad guy in Mordor? Who's?
Sauron.
Sauron, okay, yeah, he's the knower. If I remember correctly, wasn't that just the eye, the evil eye, the knower? So that's actually a good metaphor. Actually, the two citadels of the self. One is the doer, the controller, and the other one is the knower, the eye. EYE, that is, the evil eye. And that's the last citadel of the self. And that last citadel of the self, the knowing, that confuses many, many people. Even the Buddha said. So really, he said that even though this mind changes every moment, sort of people still think that this mind, the knowing, must be the self. But he said it's much better to even look at this body as a self. But if this body lasts for 20, 30, 40, 60, 80 years, he said there is nothing in there at all. Even the citta is anatta, non-self, nothing there. And this is actually the last citadel of the self. To see that which is knowing, consciousness, is also cause. It's also phenomena happening, that's all. But there's not a person inside doing the knowing. There's not somebody behind the screen living in your head somewhere who's on the other side of your eyes seeing through these eyes, or hearing through these ears, or feeling through this body. All there is just knowing arising and passing away, not a person knowing. The only way you can really get to that insight is actually to get into such deep states of meditation that first of all the doer disappears. So you know that there's no person doing the doing. It's just a process. And secondly, they go so deep into meditation that the knowing starts to disappear. Different stages of consciousness. Consciousness just falling away and disappearing, ceasing. When you see that happening, then the insight has to come up that the doer, the knower, is not a person, but just a process. And well described by the Buddha's cause and effect process called dependent origination. So instead of saying there's a self there, you say no, that what's there is dependent origination. That's why in this very beautiful sutta, Kacchana Gotu Sutta, in the Nidana Sanyutta, which became famous many years later when Nagarjuna picked it up, as a it's quite obvious, and to many commentators, including me, that Nagarjuna, sometime like 1,000 years after the Buddha passed away, he wanted to quote that to stop all of the splits between Mahayana and Theravada and unite it over that sutta about what is emptiness. Is there real emptiness, or is there really something there? And that sutta said, you can't say there's emptiness because arising is seen. You can't say there's something because a passing away is seen. He said, I teach the middle way between absolute nothing and absolute something. I call that dependent origination, the Buddha said. The process, rising and passing away. That's what life is. That's what this is. That's what the universe is. If you want to know the meaning of life, this world is founded in the dependent origination. What it is and how it works, the process and how it continues. That's all part of the insight, the seeing into non-self, which only happens as a result of very, very deep meditation, having such data that you really can't deny those truths which you see in deep meditation. Those are real things, those are facts. And when you put those facts together, then you put pieces of the jigsaw puzzle all fit together and you understand the Buddha's wisdom. You see dependent origination, you see non-self. As a result of that, you're called a stream winner. You've seen the Dhamma. You see that in here there was nothing to begin with, except this process, empty process. And you dressed it up in the sense of self, in a God, people, beings, and you realize it's just an empty process, that's all. It was Venerable Swami Buddha who said, the one who sees dependent origination sees the Dhamma. The one who sees the Dhamma sees dependent origination. And seeing the Dhamma, seeing the truth, seeing the real nature of this, is what happens at stream winning. Remember that these things can't happen according just to thinking. Only happen when thinking stops. Because all thinking is dead. It's just repeating old ideas, old thoughts, going along the same old routes. To get into enlightenment, you have to kick yourself off the normal ways of doing things. To get so still, you can take another route. Superpower mindfulness, to be able to see deeply into these things, not just superficially. And hopefully in this retreat you understand the meaning, at least, of that distinction, ordinary mindfulness and superpower mindfulness. And things become so clear and bright, you can look into things and see much deeper than a normal person, or yourself in normal consciousness. You have the power to see deeply, and also you have the special data. With that combination, there's a good chance that you might see non-self. There is nobody in there. You can't see that otherwise. In fact, the nature of things, people is to deny it all the time. Sometimes the way of denial of the self is very fascinating to see. They always try and find some place, some little corner, some niche of the cosmos where non-self doesn't apply. Yeah, everything else is non-self, but please can I keep this a little itsy-bitsy piece for myself? And that's why we have such ideas as cosmic consciousness. Sometimes we have like the non-manifest knowing. Sometimes we have the ground of all being. Sometimes we have all these little words which, when you investigate them, don't really mean very much. But they give us a hope that somewhere, some place, there might be something left. I'm sorry, folks, there's nothing left. Nothing at all. But we live in hope until we see the Dhamma. And people tell me, so what's the point of it, becoming enlightened, when you're not there to enjoy it afterwards? Well, that's it. It's just the process, it's just what happens, that's all. So eventually one sees that Dhamma, and one becomes a stream winner. And one actually sees just how stupid one was. That one couldn't see this, which the Buddha said so clearly. And the reason why one couldn't see it, because the delusion of self will never allow you to see it doesn't exist. It's self-protecting. I remember Mum once saying that when he was doing like a non-self-reflection, he could get so close to these like two citadels. I told him to go into like the know, especially, to see what is this knowing, not who knows. If you say like who knows, that's assuming there's a person, a being there, who's doing the knowing. What knows? Actually, in the Sabhasava Sutta, the Buddha actually said that asking the question, who knows, who knows, who knows, is an unprofitable inquiry, he said. Because there's an assumption there that there's somebody who knows. You want to find out who it is. It's much better to say, what knows. And it opens up the field. It could be a person, but it could be just a process. It could be something else. You're not limiting your inquiry, but you're widening it, allowing more suspects. And if you do that, what is this knowing? What is this knowing? He was getting so close that he couldn't get any further. He described it like a force field which was pushing him away and wouldn't allow him to get closer. And that's actually what happens with this sense of self. It's so self-protective. It won't allow you to actually creep up on it and actually see it for what it is. And that's again why we need these powerful mind states to be able to overcome that force, to actually to see things as they truly are. Some of that force is fear, because it's perhaps the most fearful thing for a human being to experience, that they don't exist. That is, you know, so challenging. But with the powerful meditations, you creep up on that. The Buddha said that, the great teachers say that, non-self, you've heard it so many times. And eventually you creep up on it and you see just how true that is. But not just how true, what you once thought was going to be fearful and terrifying is the most wonderful experience. To see that you're not there, there's no one there. After so many lifetimes, so many eons of going around samsara, you finally find the house builder. What delusion truly is. And why this process goes on. And what the root cause of suffering is. Avijja, not seeing things clearly. Because when there is that illusion of self, there will always be the craving and the attachments. When is a me, the Buddha said, there will always be a mine. And when is a mine, there's always the attachments. And because of impermanence, because it's based on the delusion, you'll always lose what is yours. Life is gaining things and losing them. When we gain things, we're happy and we laugh. And we cheer and celebrate. When we lose things, we cry and we suffer. You know, guilt, grief, all those things we go through in life, isn't it all about gain and loss? Gain of reputation, loss of reputation, pride, and the lack of pride, the gain of wealth and the loss of wealth, the gain of family and relations, the gain of relationships and the loss of relationships. The gain of life and the loss of life. Isn't that what the world is? Even the gain of meditation, the loss of meditation. Those of you who have had good meditations and you want to get them again, you don't own those states. If you try and own them and possess them and say they're mine, that's my jhana, then you're asking for huge trouble. You'll suffer again and again and again. That's my bliss, that's my bliss. Please, Ajahn Brahm, don't ring the bell and make us go to lunch. It's not your bliss, it just belongs to nature. Nature will take it away. Let it go, it's no big deal. So, whenever there's a self, there's always a mind. Gain and loss, that's our life. But it's so liberating to feel that you don't own anything. There is nobody there. Isn't it great? You can stuff up and there's no one who's doing the stuffing up. So who cares? You're free. That's why the experience of streamwind, seeing non-self, seeing dependent origination, is just so liberating. It's just like the Buddha said this, it's just the suffering, he said, which is left. He said, you see that those great mountains, the Himalaya mountains up there? And he picks up a bit of dirt on the end of his finger. Which is greater? So the earth and stone and rock in those great mountains, the Himalayas, not just one mountain, a whole range of them, or just a little amount of dirt on my finger. And the monk said, obviously the Himalayas have got much more dirt than what's on your little finger. He said, just the same way for a streamer, the amount of suffering they've got left is just that much compared to all the suffering they've been through in the long round of samsara. That's why for the streamer you're blissed out already. Because you realise that you've got so much, so little suffering left. Because you know, you're letting go of mine, and craving, and attachments, and all those things. You're on the way out. You've seen the Dhamma. One of the other ways of understanding what this beautiful attainment of entering the stream is actually from this simile which the Buddha gave of the seven shipwrecked sailors. And again, I often use this to describe the four stages of enlightenment, because similes, metaphors speak 1,000 words. And you can understand so much more when you put it into a very beautiful simile. And this is the Buddha simile of this ship which went down in the middle of the ocean, and 7 sailors managed to sort of jump out and sort of survive. But the first shipwrecked sailor went straight down and drowned. The second shipwrecked sailor went down and then went up again onto the surface, then went down again, then went up again, down and up, bobbing up and down. There was a second shipwrecked sailor. The third shipwrecked sailor sort of managed to stay afloat on top of the surface. The poor shipwrecked sailor was also floating on top of the surface and could look around and saw the shore, saw safety. And the fifth shipwrecked sailor, of having floated on the surface, having looked around and seen safety, started to swim towards that safe shore. And the sixth shipwrecked sailor had already swum so close to the shore, he didn't need to swim anymore. He could actually stand up and start wading through the surf to the beach. And the last shipwrecked sailor was already on the beach, underneath a coconut tree, enjoying a nice, cool coconut milk. He was safe. He was made it. And those were the seven shipwrecked sailors. And in that simile, the first shipwrecked sailor was a person who has never done any merit at all. They've lived this life just indulging upon themselves, never giving dana to monks or nuns, never giving any donations to charities, never keeping their precepts, cheating on other people, indulging themselves, acting like a slob. And when they die, they go right down. The other second shipwrecked sailor is just the average Joe and Joe. They go up, they go down, they go, they've got some good karma, sad, some bad karma. They give a donation every year to the salvos, but then they go and get drunk on Anzac Day, and then they sort of go to the pub every now and again and they fight. This is the average Joe. They go up, they go down, they go up, they go down. And the third shipwrecked sailor is the one who joins the committee of the Buddhist Society. Another similar good, like Buddhist fellowship, another similar good karma. They float on the top. They got lots and lots of good karma. And because of their good karma, they float. Now the point is, you have to have lots of good karma to float. And you also have to have lots of good karma to be able to float, like the fourth shipwrecked sailor, and be able to see the shore, to see the Dhamma, to see where suffering ends. And that's the stream winner. The one who floating because of their good karma manages to look around and see the truth. Ah, non-self, that's the truth. And that's the safety. That's the ending of suffering. No more attachments, no more cravings. That's the way. And as soon as a person becomes a stream winner, they see that. Can you imagine any shipwrecked sailor who's seen that shore, not actually swimming towards it? Or thinking, no, I'll just rest here for a while, I'll start swimming tomorrow. They can't do that. As soon as actually you've seen that shore, you start swimming. And this is actually what happens to the stream winner. As soon as you see what the problem is, the illusion of self, then you start letting go more and more and more and more and more. Because that's the process, that happens, it's natural. As soon as you see there's nobody in here, then it's as if like the roots of craving of being cut off, and the tree starts to wither and die. Letting go happens. Despite what you want to do or what you don't want to do, it just happens. It's a natural process, nothing to do as well. As you let go more and more, that's called the once returner, the one who's actually on the way to the shore. Started swimming, is on the way. And then soon comes the point where you've got past the worst of the ocean. The attachment to the body and the five senses. All the craving, thinking that pleasure lies in food, in sex, in nice clothes, nice beaches, going on nice holidays, in seeing movies, and exciting the five senses, hearing beautiful sounds, seeing beautiful things. You realize all of that is nothing compared to the beauty of the mind. The sixth shipwrecked sailor, the non-returner, is just standing up, they're still in the water, the shallows. The last bits of attachment to the beauty of the mind. And then the seven shipwrecked sailors even let go of the mind. They're just standing in safety, in emptiness. No cravings left, not wanting anything, completely at peace, content. The thing is that once that reaches the shore, sitting under the coconut tree, after a while, that last shipwrecked sailor, poof, completely vanishes. Is no longer seen. Once a person becomes enlightened, there's almost what you might call the fifth stage of enlightenment, parinibbana. And the arahat, because the whole causal sequence of rebirth is ended. The seed has been destroyed. It says in the Ratana Sutta, Kina Bija, Avirodhi Chanda, the seed has been destroyed, so no longer can grow. How is it? Kina Bija, Avirodhi Chanda, Nibbana. As they say, it's bound for Nibbana, just as this flame goes out. Yatayang Tadipo, as this lamp actually. Even in the Ratana Sutta, which many Sri Lankans know, that is also uses a simile of the lamp going out as being Nibbana. They're bound for that. It has to happen because the seed has been destroyed of avijja. And so the person who is an enlightened person, the only thing which keeps them going is past karma, just the karma of having a body keeping going. And sometimes those people do become fully enlightened. There's quite a few of those monks who, because they had nothing to do, nothing to serve, they just let go so completely, let go of the life faculty, and just died there and then. Or parinibbana, they say, not really died. And now the other monks, nuns, who continue on, only continue on for one reason, and that's actually for loving kindness, out of compassion for the world, to serve. Either to serve by being a teacher, either to serve by helping out, run monasteries, or to serve just being as a receptacle for merit in the world, understanding that those who look after arahats, who feed them, clothe them, look after them, they get immense merit. And for those reasons, out of compassion for the world, the arahat keeps on going until the time comes, the five khandhas, the body and the mental constituents, time for them to go. And then when they cease without remainder. Our parisesa nibbana, that's what parinibbana is, ceasing without remainder. And that's the end, the last stage of enlightenment. Sometimes I've given the simile, the shipwrecked sailors, by far the best simile for the four stages of enlightenment. But sometimes another simile is like of one of these meteors going around the earth or the solar system, around and around and around, countless times, and symbolizing sort of the person, or what you take to be a person, going around samsara for countless eons, around and around and around and around. But you know, with meteors, that sometimes they meet the planet Earth. And when they actually enter the atmosphere, because of the friction of the atmosphere, it gets very hot, and the meteor starts to glow, as you see like the shooting stars at night. It glows and glows and glows until it becomes so bright and so brilliant. Then it disappears forever. Finished, gone. Cease without remainder. I like that simile because it sees that after so many lifetimes, eons, of just going around in the darkness, you meet the Dhamma. When you meet the Dhamma and actually enter its atmosphere, enter the stream, then you glow brilliantly. More and more brilliantly to arahat, and then you go out this beautiful shooting star, and then gone forever. So beautiful, so lovely. And that's actually like the person becoming the arahat. It all happens so quickly once you meet the atmosphere, once you meet the Dhamma. Seven lifetimes at most. That's only for the slow ones. But the other ones are much, much quicker. This is actually the four stages of enlightenment. That's actually how it happens. So when we actually understand it's all based on non-self. As I think Jnana Taloka once said in his, I think it was in his book, the only way you can really understand what Nibbana is, what enlightenment is, if you understand what non-self is. Otherwise the whole thing doesn't make any sense. But once you really understand what non-self is, then enlightenment is very clear. And you understand just the whole process of enlightenment, four stages. You understand the little things which are given up at each stage. For stream winning, you give up basically the illusion of a self. And you also understand the path. It's not to be gained just by following rites and rituals. And it means much more than that. You understand the path is gained through the Eightfold Path. That's the way to end suffering. You've got no doubt at all. Because you've seen the Dhamma. That's the path there. And that's the way. Those are the first three hindrances which were overcome by the stream winner. The next two hindrances are sensory desire Kamachanda, the attachment to the five senses of sight, sound, smell, taste and touch, and by extension the body. Sometimes people think that these five senses are there to protect the body, that you see, you hear, you smell, you taste and you physical touch in order to keep the body going. No, the body is here to keep the five senses going. That's the job of this body, to give you a conduit into the five sense world. Which is why that if a person becomes blinded and they can't hear and they can't feel in the body will die. Because when the five senses aren't activated, what point is there for having a body? The body is there for the five senses, not the five senses there for the body. And when you become detached from those five senses, the anagami, the non-return, you're completely abandoned any concern for the body and any happiness in its five senses. The only attachments you've got left, the attachments to the bliss and happiness of the mind, or the attachment to thinking the mind is you, you know, the ultimate self, that become the anagami, the non-returner. Because once the non-returner dies, they go into the mind-made realm of the pure abodes, just enjoying themselves, just mind-made states. Never able to come back, because at least there they realize the mind sort of ceases and they let go of that last attachment. They're so close that it's inevitable anyway. And that's the non-return. You overcome, was it Rupa Raga? No, they overcome Karma Chanda and Vyapada, ill will and sensory desire. Ill will is just the other side of the coin from sensory desire. And the last five fetters which the non-returner overcomes is Rupa Raga, Arupa Raga, which is like the delight in the jhanas and delight in the arupa attainments. Realizing even those, they're just going away. So in a sense, yes, you can become attached to jhanas. But if you become attached to jhanas, you're the non-returner. And I think many of you will be very satisfied with that from this retreat. So don't be afraid of attaching to the jhanas. That's just a last little stage. That's why I say don't really worry about that at this moment. There are much bigger attachments to be worried about, not those ones. So go into those jhanas, attach them, enjoy yourself. And also you've got like pride, sense of self. No sense of self. Sense of I am better, I am the same, I am worse. That's what mana is. It comes also from measuring, from manati. Which is interesting because I've made a lot about that in recent talks, that in your meditation, don't measure how far you are going, don't measure sort of time, don't measure sort of good, bad. See if you can do the non-measuring meditation, and it leads to contentment, that leads to jhanas. So those are the attachments of the anagami, and when those attachments, what was it, mana, udicca, the last bit of restlessness, and the last bit of delusion, thinking that, you know, those happy states are the very, very best. Not understanding, not remembering, absolute nothing, ending, ceasing, poof, gone, is the best. So those are the four stages of enlightenment. I spent most of the time talking about the first stage of enlightenment, because that's probably the best, in the sense that once you get that one, then you're sweet, the other ones happen automatically as a natural result. But if you don't get that first one, then who knows, just go round and round and round, many, many more times in samsara. Many, many more nappies, many more times going to school. Many more times as a monkey, many more times being reborn with a hairy back. So streaming is the best. Okay, any questions on that? Yeah.
Then it will go, but it's all these things that are related to, like using the time, this living time. But when I listen to your talk, I thought that fear is actually the root of it, the avijja. So if you're able to understand avijja and let go, then you completely understand or let go of fear. Because I don't understand let go.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, a lot of fear is actually when attachments get challenged. And remember, with attachments, attachment is like a relationship between two things. And to have, to tie, you have to have, one person on one end of the rope, the other person on the other end of the rope, holding the object of attachment. That's why attachment is also is. You may be attached to, say, your wife, your husband, you might be attached to your body. There's also what's on the other end of that attachment. It's always the self, the me. And that's kind of, oh, that's why it's my wife, my body, my child. So you've got the child and the sense of self and the string or the rope, the fetter between, is tying the two of you together. And letting go is not just cutting that fetter. Because you can't cut that fetter, and the self just ties it again. The only way to really cut that fetter is to see what's on the other end of that rope, this stupid delusion of a self. And once that's destroyed, then there can never be any more ties, any more fetters. Which is why all fears is actually challenging the fact that this is mine. It's like nature actually telling you, it's not yours. That's why, you know, when we're afraid of someone robbing our house because there's a burglary and we're afraid, it's just nature telling us that all your possessions don't belong to you. When you get a cancer and you get afraid, it's just nature telling you, you don't own your body. When I talk about non-self and you're not the one who chooses, you get afraid because you're thinking, that's taking me away, what you're attached to. So when you have attachments, the more attachments you have, the more afraid you will be. Which is why very wealthy people are very afraid. Howard Hughes, who was so afraid he would never actually leave his house, and he had to have, I think, Mormons being his servants because they were supposed to be very moral and they would never steal. And I think he wore face masks and gloves on his hands because he was afraid of diseases and bugs and something. The more you have, the more fear you have. Well, the more you attach to it, the more fear you have. That's why when you get very deeply into a relationship and you really love someone, you're really afraid. Because you attach so much. And so when you become a monk, you know nothing. No fear. It's really great. And when sometimes the aeroplane starts to stall and you start to see flames coming out from the engine, then if you think that you're the body, then you get afraid. You think, oh, what the hell, about time to die now anyway. It's a nice way to die. I think that's the first time I was in Singapore. This is a big Singapore Airlines crash, the first time an airline ever crashed, I think, was Singapore Airlines. And I always remember that because somebody said, that dying in a plane crash is the best way to die for two reasons. Number one, it's instantaneous usually, you don't feel a thing. Because just the power of the crash, the implosion is so great. Just a big flash and then you're gone. And number two is all your relations get a big insurance payout. So a wonderful way to die. And I think number three, you don't need a cremation because it's all you've done. That's a great way to die. So why are you afraid when this is happening? You're always afraid because you think it's my body. And you are the body. If you really think you are the body, then you get very afraid when you die. So all fear comes from, it is from delusion. The delusion of my and me. So that's where fear comes from. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, it's a good question, because sometimes you see in the sutras some people seem to be enlightened without doing anything. And I imagine that somebody one day rolled into the local university and they saw that there was like a graduation ceremony. They saw these people going in there in nice suits, nice dresses, and going up when their name was called up and getting this nice scroll. And they think that's all you need to do to become graduated. So they turn up the next day in a sort of a nice suit, and they don't get a degree. So, you know, you may sort of just sit in front of the candle flame at night and hope for it to blow out, but you don't get the degree. Why? It's because you don't just get a degree on a graduation ceremony, that's actually where the photographs are taken. That's the last act in the whole play. Because, you know, anyone who's graduated, they've done years and years of study, of essays, of assignments, of examinations, and now this is the last bit, the last final act. Kisa Gotami did years of meditating, reflecting, jhanas or whatever, and that was the last act where she got her scroll of paper. And sometimes in the sutras we just see that last act, we don't know what happened before. So sometimes people get confused. They think all you need to do is just to see the, you know, see the seeing in the seeing, the hearing in the hearing, the smelling in the smelling, the tasting in the tasting, the feeling in the feeling, the knowing in the knowing. That was the Buddha's advice to Bahia, and you got enlightened straight away. You heard that? Were you enlightened? Why not? Because you didn't do the work beforehand. So you had need to do that work, and basically, even though some monks argue with me, some monks agree with me, so I stand my ground and say, yes, you do need jhanas to get streamlining. Without that, you just haven't got enough data to work on. That's why I encourage this path, why I encourage people to actually to get jhanas, because it's powerful. Once you get those jhanas, you see a different aspect of the universe. You know, sometimes people, they don't realize what happiness truly is. And people settle for second best, you know, with sex or with movies or going around travelling. It costs you so much money doing those things. And these jhanas are just $270, isn't it? And you don't even do that. Sometimes it's free. So getting those, and you really understand what bliss is, what happiness is, and you get all these other great experiences of non-self. Lots of things are missing in the jhanas. You get superpowered mindfulness. And so this is why I teach by this, so that you see how many people you can get enlightened. Yes, sir?
So jhana states are really just states of your own experience, and they don't exist themselves, and when you don't
correct.
Exist, then they don't exist.
So correct, yeah. They're just actually part of the process. It is this process, and that's one particular mode it goes into. When you let go, let go, let go, let go, let go. It goes into the jhana mode. It's just a part of the process, that's all. When you come out afterwards, but it shows you actually what switching off is, what letting go is, what cessation is. This is this other word like nirodha, cessation. Things ending, finishing. It's a very beautiful word. And it's actually, things start to cease, they end. That's why Ajahn Chah, we should say, he wanted to always find some place where things end. Because he was fed up with them going on and on and on and on. You know, you pass one exam, you always got another one afterwards. If you fail the exam, then you finish with the exams, at least for this life. You do one thing, you eat one meal, there's always another meal afterwards. You go to one retreat, well, don't you want to one day go to your last retreat? And having an ending of all this retreating business. So you want to have something with an end to it, with cessation, with finishing. Otherwise, you know, when this life ends, you have to start all over again. You go this endless cycle caused by craving, rebirth, craving, rebirth. My goodness, after a while you get bored stiff with it. How many times do you want to get married? How many times do you want to get divorced? How many times do you want to have children? How many times do you want to do these things? It's like having a rerun of these like soap operas or these movies again and again and again. How many times do you have to see this blooming movie called life? After a while, you get sick and tired of it. Okay, let's let go. And have done with it, finish, move over. And that's the way out. That's the escape from the prison. If you see yourself out of your body, so that you can go playing around if you wish, but it's called a mind-made body, Manomaya Kaya. It can be interesting, it can be fun, but it doesn't really get you anywhere. So once you've played around, say, okay, come back home and start work again. Then make a determination, an aditana, to say, okay, mind, you stay inside and don't wander off. So your mind is very conducive, it's very open actually to being programmed. You just say, stay in. Make it very clear, not sort of angry, but very forceful, and say, stay in. And the mind will stay in. Because you don't get enlightened by going out of your body. I know there's, you have some benefits. I know one prisoner who. I think you already know what's going to say next. He said, even though he was in jail, he could go to a movie every night if he wanted to. He just leave his body and go to the movie theatre. Check out what his wife was up to. But I mean, it's just playing around, just games. So no need to get into that. If you want to, it's interesting, have a bit of fun. But you don't get enlightened that way. So just tell you, Mike, stay at home. So thank you for listening to the four stages of enlightenment. At least you get one stage. Or maybe all the stages, who knows, in this lifetime. You can do it. If you haven't, it means you just haven't yet. And the Eightfold Path is a way. The Eightfold Path includes jhanas, includes mindfulness, includes all your precepts, includes right view, right intention, the whole works. So if you cultivate the Eightfold Path, it leads to all those four stages of enlightenment. So we now have interview time. So have a nice, fun, meditate, let go, get jhanas, and see if you can also get streaming.